On this 28th day of March 2011 in San Diego, we are reading from the Srimad Bhagavad Gita as it is, translation and commentary, by His Divine Grace A.C. Bhaktivedanta Swami Prabhupada. We are in chapter 1 entitled Observing the Armies on the Battlefield of Kurukshetra. And we will read texts 32 through 35. So when you chant them, just chant one of these. Okay. King no Rajena Govinda,
King no Rajena Govinda,
Kim bo gar jivitena va,
Kim bo gar jivitena va,
Yesham arte kankshitang no,
Yesham arte kankshitang no,
Rajam bhoga sukhani cha,
Rajam bhoga sukhani cha,
Tahime vastitha yudhe,
Tahime vastitha yudhe,
Pranang chakva dhanani cha, Acharya pitarak putras,
Acharya pitarak putras,
Tathaiva chapitamaha,
Tathaiva chapitamaha,
Matula swasura pautra,
Matula swasura pautra,
Shalak sambandhinastata,
Shalak sambandhinastata,
Eta nahantum
icchami,
Gnatopi madusudana,
Api
trailokya
rajasya,
Heto kingnu mahikrite, Nahatya data rastrana, Ka priti syajanardana, Balaram.
King
Norajena Govinda,
King
Bogar Jivitenava, Yeshamarte Kangshitang
no,
Rajam Boga Sukhanicha, did you go?
King
Norajena
Govinda,
King Bogar Jivitenava, Shamache Kamsitang no
Rajam Boga Sukhanicha.
Ben, you can chant the next one.
I was prepared for the first one. Taime Vastita Yudhe.
Taime Vastite Yudhe. O Govinda, of what avail to us are a kingdom, happiness, or even life itself when all those for whom we may desire them are now arrayed on this battlefield? O Madhusudana, when teachers, fathers, sons, grandfathers, maternal uncles, fathers-in-law, grandsons, brothers-in-law, and other relatives are ready to give up their lives and properties and are standing before me, why should I wish to kill them, even though they may otherwise kill me? O maintainer of all living entities, I am not prepared to fight with them even in exchange for the three worlds, let alone this earth. What pleasure will we derive from killing the sons of Dhritarashtra? Purport. Arjuna has addressed Lord Krishna as Govinda because Krishna is the object of all pleasures for cows and the senses. By using this significant word, Arjuna indicates that Krishna should understand what will satisfy Arjuna's senses. But Govinda is not meant for satisfying our senses. If we try to satisfy the senses of Govinda, however, then automatically our own senses are satisfied. Materially, everyone wants to satisfy his senses, and he wants God to be the order supplier for such satisfaction. The Lord will satisfy the senses of the living entities as much as they deserve, but not to the extent that they may covet. But when one takes the opposite way, namely when one tries to satisfy the senses of Govinda without desiring to satisfy one's own senses, then by the grace of Govinda, all desires of the living entity are satisfied. Arjuna's deep affection for community and family members is exhibited here partly due to his natural compassion for them. He is therefore not prepared to fight. Everyone wants to show his opulence to friends and relatives, but Arjuna fears that all his relatives and friends will be killed on the battlefield, and he will be unable to share his opulence after victory. This is a typical calculation of material life. The transcendental life, however, is different. Since a devotee wants to satisfy the desires of the Lord, he can, Lord willing, accept all kinds of opulence for the service of the Lord. And if the Lord is not willing, he should not accept a farthing. Arjuna did not want to kill his relatives, and if there were any need to kill them, he desired that Krishna kill them personally. At this point, he did not know that Krishna had already killed them before their coming onto the battlefield, and that he was only to become an instrument for Krishna. This fact is disclosed in following chapters. As a natural devotee of the Lord, Arjuna did not like to retaliate against his miscreant cousins and brothers. But it was the Lord's plan that they should all be killed. The devotee of the Lord does not retaliate against the wrongdoer, but the Lord does not tolerate any mischief done to the devotee by the miscreants. The Lord can excuse a person on his own account, but he excuses no one who has done harm to his devotees. Therefore, the Lord was determined to kill the miscreants, although Arjuna wanted to excuse them. Om Gyanat Timarandasya Gyanandana Shalakaya Chakshu Unmidatam Mena Tasmai Shri Gurave Namaha. I was born in the darkness of ignorance. My spiritual master, Srila Prabhupada, opened my eyes with the torchlight of knowledge. I offer my humble obeisance unto him and all members of Sri Prabhupada. So, it's coming to the Bhagavad Gita without knowing the background of the rest of the Mahabharata, one may not fully appreciate the evil-mindedness, if you will, of the other side. So therefore, let's just review quickly what Duryodhana and company had done to try to usurp this kingdom. So even in their childhood, when the Pandavas were children growing up, Duryodhana was conspiring to kill them. And there was a poison cake, I think. They pushed them down a mountain. There were all these different efforts to kill them. And most famously later on was the House of Lack. You know, they were invited to go live at a certain town, the name of which escapes me at the moment. And Dhritarashtra approved of this. And it was built in such a way that if one little match, the whole thing would go up. It was lack. Lack is the stuff that shellac is made from. I looked this up. It's not shellac. It's lack. Lack is a certain exudation from an insect that's very, very flammable. And immediately as they walked into that building, there was a certain smell about it, and they were suspicious. And Vidura had hinted to them that this was a dangerous place. He couldn't give explicitly because he was living under the protection of Dhritarashtra in his palace. But he hinted to them that this would burn up and it could be dangerous. So, and they understood that. And so with the help of a friend of Vidura's, they were able to escape digging a tunnel. But then they were in exile. They were out in the forest, you know. And they knew that if Duryodhana and company knew where they were, they would send soldiers to kill them. They didn't have an army or anything. So this went on. And then there was the famous gambling match, the rigged gambling match. And the Kshatriya of Yudhishthira, being Dharma personified, that when he was challenged to a gambling match, even though he suspected foul play, he had to accept. And even as Shakuni, he was expert at cheating, kept beating Yudhishthira, and it was obviously fixed. He still kept betting until everything was gone. Even himself, and ultimately Draupadi. And then you had this, you know, most famous of all was the attempted disrobing of Draupadi. Well, now she was bet, you know, and therefore the Pandavas had no proprietorship, and so she was brought in, dragged in by this nasty Dukshasana. And attempted to be disrobed. So this was the final injustice, horrible breach of etiquette and dharma. And so all of this, plus they kept usurping their kingdom. They were the rightful heirs of Pandu, who was the eldest son. But Dhritarashtra, being controlled by the love for his sons, did not recognize that. So this whole thing. So with that understanding, and you realize that, and every attempt was made to have some kind of compromise. Okay, okay, you can have the kingdom, but give us some villages to run to rule, because Kshatriyas have to rule. They can't be servants. They can't be farmers. You know, that's their business. They're not Brahmins, teachers. No, you can't have as much land as you can stick a pin in. And this was Duryodhana's verdict. So with all of that, a war had to come. There had to be a war. It was inevitable. So with that background, we understand that, okay, war means that one side is going to be wiped out. And that side was the side of Duryodhana. Now, because they were going to be killed in the presence of Krishna, their sins would be wiped away. They would go to a higher destination. They would be blessed because of that. So ultimately, it was to their benefit to be killed in that situation. But Arjun was overwhelmed by the bodily relationship. The whole point of this first chapter is to set up Arjun's dilemma and his being the example of someone who has forgotten the transcendental knowledge, it simply is working on bodily considerations. It wasn't that he was afraid to die. That's clear. Arjun was a trained Kshatriya. They're trained to face death in battle. But what he was afraid of was killing all his loved ones. And as he's explained, he's laying out his argument here. And the interesting thing is he based it on the Vedas. He says, I have heard from the Vedas that when the men are all killed, the women are unprotected, and Varna Sankara, unwanted population, grows in society, and society becomes chaotic, and I'll be responsible, right, for killing all these people. So I don't want that sin on my head. I don't want society to go. So he was, that was one argument. The other was, okay, suppose I fight and I win, but I'll have a kingdom now. I'll be part of the ruling party of the kingdom. The Pandavas will rule together. Great. But all the people I love, who I would like to share this with, I will have soaked, their blood will soak the earth. And I'll have that on my head. How can I enjoy the kingdom? So both from a positive and negative material side, he's made an argument. On the negative side, I don't want to get all the sinful reactions for creating all these, you know, widows and these unprotected children and all this. And on the positive side, even if I look at it, okay, at least I'll have the kingdom. But that pleasure will be nothing because all my loved ones will be dead and I'll be responsible for killing them. So my guilty conscience will prevent me from enjoying the kingdom. So you see the perfect argument. From the material side, you should go to the forest. And now he's going to lay out some of these things that I just mentioned. Sin will overcome us if we say the aggressive. That's the next verse. So it's concise. He uses this, the rest of the chapter here. And the beginning of the next chapter, to lay out his dilemma. And in a sense, we can relate to that. Because we also have these material considerations that seem to be, you know, preventing us from seriously practicing Krishna consciousness. Practically every one of us. I know I did when I came to, you know, fully practice Krishna consciousness, which is what Arjun's going to do. He's going to fully surrender. What about your future life? What about us? You know, I have my parents, they were getting on in age, you know. What about your education? What about this? What about that? You know? We put so much money in, you know, it's crazy, you know? This whole philosophy doesn't mean, you know, it's just a passing phase. It's part of the hippie era, you know, whatever. There's a whole set of arguments based on material things. And indeed, materially, what we do doesn't make any sense. Let's face it. You know, if people just look at it from a material point of view, let's face it, they think we're nuts. You know, we're not. All the things that go into making what they consider to be a successful life, a pleasurable life, a fun life, we're working against that. We're reducing that to practically nil. So it's almost like, you know, like 180 degrees. And that's exactly what's being set up here. Arjun has to transcend all of these impulses that you may say are natural for a materialist to have. And he's a kind person. He's compassionate. He's not, you know, some vicious warmonger who just doesn't care about all this stuff. He's sensitive. He's a, you know, mature, sensitive human being. And so it's very graphic. You know, the whole thing, the Bhagavad Gita is organized very nicely and very concisely to lay out the dilemma that all of us face. of going by our material calculations, however nice or good, you know, materially they may seem, or the instruction and the desire of Krishna. That's really what's happening here. Okay, any comments or questions on these points? Yes, sir.
So, it says, when one takes the opposite way, namely, when one tries to satisfy the senses of Govinda without desiring to satisfy one of his own senses, by the grace of Govinda, all desires of the living entity are satisfied. But if we go into satisfying the senses of Krishna, knowing that he's going to, in return, satisfy our own senses, then how can we do it without having the desire to satisfy our own senses?
Okay, that's a good question. Okay, so it's a good question by Bhakta Alec. Srila Prabhupada mentions this idea of Govinda, that's the name that he's using here. And what does the name Govinda mean? So go can mean cows, and go can mean senses. And Govinda means one who satisfies the cows and who satisfies the senses. So the statement is made here, and we know, you know, this is the basic Krishna consciousness. If you forget about Govinda and you just try to satisfy your senses directly, you will suffer. We've seen that. And, you know, that's right in the Bhagavad Gita. But if you satisfy Govinda's senses, then all of your senses will really be satisfied. So on both sides, the calculation is to satisfy my senses, right? But now I know how to do it. I'm going to satisfy Krishna's. So that's okay. In other words, this is why Prabhupada put it in here. The idea is that inevitably, because of our conditioning, we are thinking of in terms of our own benefit, short-term, long-term, whatever it is. But if we come within the society of devotees and we get exposed to this philosophy, then we wake up and we realize, actually, we can't really enjoy by just trying to do what everyone else is doing, just to please the body, subtle or gross, extended, whatever it is. When the body is the basis of your enjoyment and happiness, so-called happiness and peace, you fail. Because the body is inevitably subject to decay and always changing. So, okay, I realize that now. So how can I be happy? Oh, you'll be happy by serving Govinda. Right? All right, let me try that. So I'll chant Hare Krishna, and I'll do what these Hare Krishnas say. And because they say it's pleasing to Govinda. He looks pleased on the altar. Yeah, okay, it's working. So the idea is that all of us are like little Dhruva Maharajas. Dhruva also went into this whole process wanting something for himself. Okay, I understand. By chanting Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya, I can get the kingdom. By standing on one leg and, you know, practicing pranayama and doing all these, I can get my kingdom. By worshiping this, actually, a little deity worship. If you look, read the chapter, you know, you can worship deity in the forest by making it anew each day, worshiping, and then at the end of the day, you can wash away, make a new one. That's bona fide. So Narada Muni taught him all these things. So the idea is you go into this process with this motive in mind, but you're following the process. And what happens is that after a while, you forget about your own pleasure. Because the pleasure that comes from serving Krishna is beyond what you had imagined to be your own sense pleasure. You're thinking, oh, if I serve Govinda, then the senses will be pleased in the way that I'm accustomed to. But that's not what happens. You know, this nice little phrase from the Sandarbhas comes up. I'm going to keep pounding away until this is kind of automatic. Bhajaniya padama purusha sukamatra swasukatvam. This is like a prose phrase, but it's very instructive. So bhajaniya is the worshipable one. That's the name for Krishna. That's you know, it's understood in the context. Bhajaniya, who is Padma Purusha, the Supreme Person. Sukha, his happiness. Matra Swasukatvam is my only matra source of my happiness, Swasukatvam. So the idea is that it's not so much that the senses are pleased like we're accustomed to, But look like a mother. You know, it's so nice to go back to mother and child, because that's the closest thing we have to this kind of selfless love. You know, so the mother is looking at the child. The child is peacefully sleeping, or the child is looking up at the mother, smiling with, you know, those few teeth coming in. You know, so what is, so the mother is delighted. So you could say the eyes are pleased by seeing that. But not pleased in the ordinary way of seeing some nice picture or something. Is it? Pleased because of the love for the child. But the same kind of, but the eyes are being pleased. Is it? And similarly, you see Krishna on the altar. It's not just that he's beautiful, you know, but that there's some background of service here. You're seeing him with some eyes that are informed by the fact that you have a relationship with Krishna, you know, and you know who he is, and you know that, in other words, there's something more to it than just seeing nice colors, you know, or a nice doll or something. Someone who walks in with absolutely no knowledge will see differently than a devotee sees, even a neophyte devotee. So this is how the senses become pleased, and you can see that it's not ordinary, because you know, the great devotees, like Ekadashi is coming up. Or like take Maharaj Ambarish. You know, Maharaj Ambarish is famous for engaging all the senses, right? There's a whole verse. You know, first his mind was on Krishna, then he used his words, his voice, to glorify the Lord. His hands to clean the temple, his ears to hear the glories. And one of them is that he uses his tongue to taste the tulsi leaves offered on the prasadam. It's not so much the taste of the prasadam, it's the fact that it's offered to Govinda. That's the whole idea. So there's one tulsi leaf, right? And he's tasting. And, you know, great devotees, they'll go into ecstasy. Say it's a Ekadashi or something, you know, they taste the tulsi leaf. And so the tongue is being used, but it's not being pleased in the ordinary way, right? Not because of nice taste, it's because of who that tulsi is and what's been, you see what I mean? So this is how your senses become pleased in relation to Govinda. There is, of course, also, you know, pleasing sounds of glorification. That element can be mixed in. But there's instructive in this regard is Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati's ashram, you know, when he started to go to the Amat, so many devotees were there. And so they would have kirtan, you know, like we have kirtan, we have arti and everything. So sometimes he would specifically choose those devotees who didn't have much musical skill to lead the kirtan. Just to get away from the idea that, oh, I like it because it's a nicely sung. No, it's the devotion and the fact that it's Krishna's name that we should appreciate. You know, so the senses are being pleased, but it's not exactly the ear with the nice music. So it's that idea. Okay, let's go on. I'll see you soon. Papam ebashayir asman. Hadvaitan atatayinaha. Tasmanarhavayam hantum. Datarastran sabandavam. Swajanam hikatam hatva. Sukina siyama marava. Sin will overcome us if we slay such aggressors. Therefore, it is not proper for us to kill the sons of Dhritarashtra and our friends. What should we gain, O Krishna, husband of the goddess of fortune? And how could we be happy by killing our own kinsmen? Purport. According to Vedic injunctions, there are six kinds of aggressors. One, a poison giver. Two, one who sets fire to the house. Three, one who attacks with deadly weapons. Four, one who plunders riches. Five, one who occupies another's land. And six, one who kidnaps a wife. Such aggressors are at once to be killed, and no sin is incurred by killing such aggressors. So they fulfilled every one of these. This is the point here, the Duryodhana company. Such killing of aggressors is quite befitting any ordinary man, but Arjuna was not an ordinary person. He was saintly by character, and therefore he wanted to deal with them in saintliness. This kind of saintliness, however, is not for a Kshatriya. Although a responsible man in the administration of a state is required to be saintly, he should not be cowardly. For example, Lord Ram was so saintly that people even now are anxious to live in the kingdom of Lord Ram, Ram Rajya. But Lord Ram was never showed any cowardice. Ravana was an aggressor against Ram because Ravana kidnapped Ram's wife, Sita. But Lord Ram gave him sufficient lessons, unparalleled in the history of the world. In Arjuna's case, however, one should consider the special type of aggressors, namely his own grandfather, own teacher, friends, sons, grandsons, etc. Because of them, Arjuna thought that he should not take the severe steps necessary against ordinary aggressors. Besides that, saintly persons are advised to forgive. Such injunctions for saintly persons are more important than any political emergency. Arjuna considered that rather than kill his own kinsmen for political reasons, it would be better to forgive them on grounds of religion and saintly behavior. He did not, therefore, consider such killing profitable simply for the matter of temporary bodily happiness. After all, kingdoms and the pleasures derived therefrom are not permanent, so why should he risk his life and eternal salvation by killing his own kinsmen? Arjuna's addressing of Krishna as Madhava, or the husband of the goddess of fortune, is also significant in this connection. He wanted to point out to Krishna that as the husband of the goddess of fortune, he should not induce Arjuna to take up a matter which would ultimately bring about misfortune. Krishna, however, never brings misfortune to anyone, to say nothing of his devotees. So, Srila Prabhupada is expanding on the argument here. As I pointed out, the Kurus had fulfilled all of these reasons. Any one of them is enough to attack the aggressor. And they had given poison. They had set fire to the house of Lakh. And they certainly attacked with deadly weapons. They plundered their riches by the cheating gambling match. They occupied the land, which was rightfully their kingdom, and they kidnapped their wife, Draupadi, by trying to disrobe her. So they were certainly worthy to be chastised and killed by the Pandavas. But there's this other consideration. Because they were intimately related to them, there's this other consideration. And that's what Arjuna is following now. Like I mentioned last time, he's following his gut reaction. And we would have the same reaction. You know, in the Civil War, there were often families divided, north and south. It was very painful in that regard. That's what, you know, when a country is in a civil war, it's a special type of war. And there's a lot more pain, emotional pain involved, to speak of the, you know, physical pain of the battle itself. So that physical suffering was not what Arjuna is considering here. He's a Kshatriya, he's trained, he's ready to kill and be killed. But this other consideration that the, you know, the grandfather, Bhishma, and Drona, his teacher, this is what gave him pause. And so this is a significant point, is that on the basis of this emotional reaction, he built an argument. You see? He built an argument, a logical argument. And he even cites the Vedas. I have heard, I think in the next one of the next verses, I have heard means that it's in the Vedas. You know, if the women are unprotected, Varnashaita. So that type of thing. So this is what happens. When there's no, you're not under the influence, if you will, of the revealed scripture and the realized saints in Parampara, then you tend to put the intelligence under the control of the emotions. This is called the lower self ruling the higher self. You see, if you remember in the third canto, the third chapter at the end, Krishna gives a hierarchy, right? Ultimately, there's a super soul, which he doesn't mention there, but that's clear from the, you know, the super soul, the soul, the ego, the intelligence, mind, senses. And we're supposed to work with that hierarchy. In other words, when we take our instructions from the super soul, then the intelligence becomes purified and controls the mind and senses so that they don't go out and degrade the soul. The uncontrolled senses and the uncontrolled mind is one's worst enemy, Krishna says in the sixth chapter. So that control is supposed to be there. And then the senses and the mind are naturally used in the service of Krishna, in the service of the super soul. But when the things are backwards, when you have no access to the instructions of the super soul, you're just working, you're in the modes of nature, then everything is backwards. The sense objects control the senses and the mind. This is the whole point of advertising. I like to point that out. They try to put these objects of the senses in front of your eyes and ears You know, and if those, if possible, you know, if you're walking along the street and there's a restaurant, they'll pump it out into the street so that you'll be attracted, you know. And the intelligence, you know, and the mind are used, oh, how can I make enough money so I can buy this thing? Rather, you see what I'm saying? So a similar thing is happening here, is that Arjuna does not want to fight. Gut reaction, doesn't want to kill Bhishma, he doesn't want to kill Drona, he doesn't want to kill his grandchildren and, you know, all this list here, fathers-in-law, brothers-in-law, extended family. And therefore, he's come up with an argument. The intelligence is being used in the service of the emotions, which we're not supposed to be controlled by, certainly not in spiritual life. So that's a universal principle. It's all the time, you know, that people want to do something and they make up an argument, sometimes very skillfully, to convince others that it's the, and even to convince themselves that it's the right thing to do. And therefore you get all kinds of bogus so-called dharmas, disciplines. I like to give the example of myself as, you know, when I was trained, this may come as a shock, as a communist in the 50s. I was just a kid, but every night my father would open his book that he kept in the closet because he thought the FBI was going to come to get him. It was Marx and Engels. I don't know if these names mean anything to you, but this was, these are the high, you know, priests of the communist movement back in the 19th century. They wrote all this stuff, and okay, that's you know, that's the way I began seeing the world. You know, of course I was living, you know, in the West, an ordinary child in many ways, but that was my religion. That's the way I saw everything. And so you know, that went on and on and for until like 1991 or so. And then the whole thing collapsed. The Russia or the Soviet Union that was built on this so-called philosophy, it was hollow. It really didn't work. It was a false philosophy, a false religion, if you will, false dharma. And now nobody believes it, really. Some may say that they do. They still have a communist party, but they don't believe it anymore. Everyone believes in this religion, you know, accumulation of wealth and investment, you know, and build up. And that's also crazy. I mean, you can see that it's the whole earth is going to collapse on, you know. You can't have an ever-expanding consumer society like we have in America. China wants to be like America. So does India. How many people is that? It's like, what, 2.5 billion people or more, almost 3 billion people. Can they all live like we live here, even with this economic recession? You know, the cars, and it's impossible. But that's what they want. So you can see that there's going to be a big clash there. It's not going to happen. So the whole idea of capitalism, which is based, after all, on greed, it's the lowest kind of emotion and, you know, gut reaction, mode of passion. But there's a whole philosophy. You have economists, you have people, you know, and you even have religion. Like the Western religion, very, you know, there's different branches, of course, to Christianity. But I know that the Puritans and the Protestant ethic, I don't know if you've heard of the Protestant ethic, when they came over and they colonized, you know, and they beat back the Indians and everything. So what were they doing? They were very strict. You know, you'll see these Puritans, you know, there's even a famous painting. Yes, you know, very strict, you know. But the whole idea is we'll go to church, we'll pray, you know, we'll survive in this difficult land, and we'll prosper. God will shower his blessing, and we'll prosper economically. You know, the abundance of this earth will be ours. So that's trying to bring God as an order supplier into our service. We'll go to church, we'll practice, we'll be, you know, have strict morals in our life so that we can get more money and we can prosper on this earth and be happy. It's complete illusion. It's bringing God into the service, Dharma into the service of our material desires. And that's not the way it works. You know, God's desires are first, and then we become happy. Varnashram Dharma, with God in the center, chanting Hare Krishna. There's no economic benefit to it. You know, you're spending time. I spent a half an hour chanting Hare Krishna. I could have been making money. There's no material benefit to it, you know. But it's the greatest benefit for the soul. Anyway, any questions on these points? Okay, Prabhupada talks about Ram Raj, about Madhava, right? So the point here is that Krishna or Rama, they're, you know, perfectly saintly, but they annihilated so many demons, you know, who were against Dharma. So that's not that's the desire of the Lord that happened. Certainly, we'll see that this is Krishna's desire. Yeah.
With Ram Raj, is that like an ideal
system? Ram Raj means the rule of Ram as a king of the whole world. Ayodhya. You know, after he killed Ravana, and he was enthroned as the king. Remember, he wasn't coronated. He left for the forest. He was supposed to be in an odd day. You know, he had to leave, remember? So then when he comes back after killing Ravana, then the whole earth prospered under this, you know, perfect rule of Ram. So we're you know, everyone is in India, you know, this is great. We love to have that. But Prabhupada points out, then you have to become devotees of Ram. You can't have the wonderful prosperity and the morality and the ethics without yourself being a devotee of Ram. You know? Again, you're trying to bring Ram Raj into your service. The whole idea is that they were all devotees of Ram. You know, they were sacrificing for him. They were meditating on him. They were glorifying him. And then everything works nicely. But, yeah, Ram Raja is famous. But, again, you know, without understanding how real Ram Raja can take place, it devolves into, you know, sentimentality. That's the idea. Okay, what time is it? All right. Yad yapyate na pasyanti. Lobho pahata chetasaha. Kulakshaya kutam dosham. Mitra drohe chapatakam. Katam na geyam asmabhi. Papad asman nivartitum. Kulakshayakutam dosham. Papashyad bir janardana. O Janardana, although these men, their hearts overtaken by greed, see no fault in killing one's family or quarreling with friends, why should we, who can see the crime in destroying a family, engage in these acts of sin? Purport. A Kshatriya is not supposed to refuse to battle or gamble when he is so invited by some rival party. Under such an obligation, Arjuna could not refuse to fight, because he had been challenged by the party of Duryodhana. In this connection, Arjuna considered that the other party might be blind to the effects of such a challenge. Arjuna, however, could see the evil consequences and could not accept the challenge. Obligation is actually binding when the effect is good, but when the effect is otherwise, then no one can be bound. Considering all these pros and cons, Arjuna decided not to fight. So the point is that Arjuna was prepared to depart from the usual Kshatriya Dharma, which is to always accept the fight, for the higher good of not incurring sin or, as he will say, to, you know, destroy the whole society by killing all the men and the women get unprotected. And, you know, so he's thinking, well, okay, I'll deviate from my Kshatriya Dharma for the greater good. It's one argument after another. Personally, I see no reason to get this kingdom because it'll be soaked in blood of my friends and relatives. I don't want it, you know. And on the negative side, all, you know, such great souls as Bhishma and Drona will be killed, and that's another reason why I shouldn't do it. You know, it's horrible. And then here he's counteracting the idea that, well, as a Kshatriya, you have to fight because you've been challenged. So no, there's a higher motive here, because the effect will be so bad that following that Kshatriya Dharma doesn't pertain in this case. So he's going through one after another. Kulakshaye pranashyanti. Kula dharma sanatana. Dharme nashte kulam kritsnam. Adharmo bibhavatyuta. With the destruction of the dynasty, the eternal family tradition is vanquished, and thus the rest of the family becomes involved in irreligion. Purport. In the system of the Varnashram institution, there are many principles of religious traditions to help members of the family grow properly and attain spiritual values. The elder members are responsible for such purifying processes in the family, beginning from birth to death. But on the death of the elder members, such family traditions of purification may stop, and the remaining younger family members may develop irreligious habits and thereby lose their chance for spiritual salvation. Therefore, for no purpose should the elder members of the family be slain. And there were plenty of elder members of the family on the battlefield. So what's very interesting here is that, you know, all of these arguments make perfect sense unless you take the presence of Krishna into account. In other words, you take Krishna out of the equation, and even from a Vedic point of view, these arguments make all kinds of sense. But just like this one, that you're thinking that, well, irreligion will become predominant if I kill all these elders, because they're the ones who preserve the religious culture and hand it down to the youngsters. Makes perfect sense. It's true. But Krishna is religion personified. He wants this battle to take place. Therefore, whatever discrepancies might have arisen if Krishna wasn't there and it's just an ordinary battle, will be negated and be solved because of Krishna's desire. Just like this, you know, killing of all of these soldiers. But it's a blessing because they're killed in the presence of Krishna. So this is exactly what happens in a secular society. Krishna's out of the picture, right? God is out of the picture. And now we just have to figure things out on our own. And they have the whole humanist tradition. You know, people of goodwill, they're not, you know, out and out evil demons. They want the best for society. But they just want it on a humanist level. How can we, you know, increase the welfare? Okay, we'll have, child care. You know, this came up, child. Well, everyone's, the women are all working now. So the children have to, we'll have government-supported child care. That will be for the welfare of people. Okay. So, and this goes on. But God is out of the picture. You know, really, there's no calculation there, any religion or anything. It's just on the basis of, well, the child has to be taken care of, you know, so the mother can work and so that the family can do it. But actually, you know, if you look at it on a long-term basis, or look at it, you know, like change your perspective a little bit, what is it about a society where both the man and the woman have to work and the children will be taken care of by strangers? What they're talking about Varnasankara. Well, this is a good way to grow Varnasankara. You know, have the children all taken care of by strangers instead of the parents. And then when it comes time for the parents to try to instill moral values or something, or just, they're strangers. You know, Prabhupada would point out, it's so distorted, you know, the workaday world in the city. Father leaves early in the morning before dawn, before you know, the sun comes up, because he has such a long commute. He's talking about India, you know, that they have to be on the train for so many hours. And he comes back after the little kid is asleep. He doesn't even know who his father is. The father wakes up, you know, the kid wakes up one day and sees his father. He gets scared. Who is this strange man in the house? See how distorted it all gets. You know? What to speak of, the mother isn't even there now anymore because she's working also. So you see, what seems like a good value, because it's not following traditional, you know, varnashram, and what the roles are supposed to be, turns out to be a source of exactly this varnasankara, this unwanted, untrained, mad population that we have today. You know, many of you, I was very fortunate in the 50s to have an intact family. My mother took care of me. I had a good relationship, you know. I mean, even on a material level, that's so important for the emotional development. But everyone knows, you know, that so it's rare to have a mother and a father live happily and have even a nuclear family. You know, what's the, you know, divorce rate is 50% or something. It's horrible. But the humanists don't realize that. They just work with the individual problem that's developed because they don't have the overall view. So similarly, Arjuna is looking at his immediate problem here, making up an argument, you know, drawing from the Vedas even, to justify what he doesn't want to do. And he's going to completely convince himself. But then in the seventh verse in the second chapter, everything is resolved by saying, well, I got to admit, I really don't know how to figure it out. So you instruct me. That's going to be the key eventually. Yeah.
So under the principle of, you know, that Arjuna brought up in the last verse, that you know, he's not obliged to fight if it's going to result in, a bad result for society. Then why is it that when the gambling match took place that they didn't pull out then? Because, I mean, by doing that gambling match, that was what, caused them to lose the kingdom and, everything. I mean, if they hadn't done that, then...
Well, this you could say that, this was one of the characteristics of Yudhishthira. He was dharmic almost to a fault, and it comes out more explicitly in the battle, where this famous pastime where the only way to kill Dronacharya was to get him depressed, to get him discouraged. And the best way to do that was if his son, Ashwatthama, was killed, right? But his son Ashwatthama was not killed. So Krishna, who is not bound by any of these laws, he said to Yudhishthira, I want you to declare loudly, to shout out that Ashwatthama is slain, to lie, so that Dronacharya would be weakened and Arjuna could kill him. So he refused. He could not tell a lie. He hadn't told a lie up till then. He wasn't about to start right then, So for this, he had to see the hellish planets because he refused Krishna, you see? In other words, it's exactly the same thing. It seems that the dharmic thing to do is always right. But sometimes there's a higher dharma, which is Krishna's direct order. And that's really what we should follow.
Also in the gambling match, Yudhishthira could not really know what was the intention, how far the other side was going to go, what was the intention of the other side. Plus, at that time it was not known that Shakuni had dice, which was basically...
No, but the point is it went on, and they kept, he kept losing and losing.
You're in, right? But point is whether you're going to get in or not.
But don't forget, he came back a second time. He had already had experience with Shakuni, and then they challenged again he walks back again, and this time they lose the bet, they get exiled. So, but the point was that Yudhishthira followed everything to the letter. And in a sense that, on a larger perspective, this enabled the battle to take place and the final cleansing to take place. So the good effect ultimately was there. But you're right that it's possible to... And, Krishna talks about this. This is when we talk about smarta Brahmins, we talk about those who follow all the rules and regulations but don't see the essence of it. You see? When Prabhupada came to America, he had to bend so many rules. This ashram, Brahmacharini ashram, there's nothing like that. The sannyasis performing marriages for their disciples, there's nothing like that. And he's getting criticism from his godbrothers. Swamiji is departing, he's deviating, But he saw you had to bend because the essence had to be there. The Yuga Dharma was going on and it was spreading and, things. We introduced all these rules later on. Even the four regs weren't there at first. So ultimately, Dharma has to be judged from the greater perspective. It was ultimately good that Yudhishthira followed this, thing. But so you have to always see the long term effect of it. Okay, actually, I think what do we have here? Did we read 40? Oh, we didn't read 40. All right, let's read 40. But we're going to read 40 tomorrow also because this is kind of a quoted verse. Adharma vibhavat Krishna padishyanti kulastriyaha strishu dushtasu varshneya jayate varna sankaraha. When irreligion is prominent in the family, O Krishna, the women of the family become polluted, and from the degradation of womanhood, O descendant of Vrishni, comes unwanted progeny. Report. Good population in human society is the basic principle for peace, prosperity, and spiritual progress in life. The Varnashram religion's principles were so designed that the good population would prevail in society for the general spiritual progress of state and community. Such population depends on the chastity and faithfulness of its womanhood. As children are very prone to be misled, women are similarly very prone to degradation. Therefore, both children and women require protection by the elder members of the family. By being engaged in various religious practices, women will not be misled into adultery. According to Chanaka Pandit, women are generally not very intelligent and therefore not trustworthy. Generally. present company accepted. So the different family traditions or religious activities should always engage them, and thus their chastity and devotion will give birth to good population eligible for participating in the varnashram system. On the failure of such varnashram dharma, naturally the women become free to act and mix with men, and thus adultery is indulged in at the risk of unwanted population. Irresponsible men also provoke adultery in society, and thus unwanted children flood the human race at the risk of war and pestilence. So we will discuss this verse tomorrow. Om again. Srila Prabhupada Ki Jai.